The book, Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Know All the Facts. Now, what makes this book special is that it's written by Annie Duke. Now, you may recognize her name. She went head-to-head with Joan Rivers on The Celebrity Apprentice. But more importantly, she's one of the top poker players in the U.S. She's earned a World Series of Poker bracelet, and she's the only woman to win the NBC National Poker Heads-Up Championship. But there's more. Annie started her career as an academic going for a PhD in cognitive science before she went into poker. So she mixed those two things together and produced an amazing guide to making better decisions. And that's the book, Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Know All the Facts. And welcome, Annie Duke.
Thanks for having me.
It's a great book. It's filled with so many stories and ways to think and the ways to change our thinking in order to get better outcomes. But at the outset of your book, you tell the story of Super Bowl 49. The Seahawks coach Pete Carroll made one of the most controversial calls in football history. Briefly describe that for us.
Sure. So it's the end of the fourth quarter. There's 26 seconds left in the whole game. The Seahawks are on the Patriots' one-yard line. It's second down. They have one timeout, and they're down by four. So what's important to know here in terms of kind of why there was this reaction to what happened is that there's a consensus play that Pete Carroll can call, which would be a running play, to hand it off to the running back, Marshawn Lynch, who's one of the best short yardage running backs in the history of the game. So everybody's expecting on second down, 26 seconds left, down by four, that he's going to hand it off to Marshawn Lynch. Marshawn Lynch is going to try to sort of barrel through the Patriots line and attempt to score. Instead, Pete Carroll does something really unexpected. He calls for Russell Wilson to pass the ball. Russell Wilson does pass the ball. The ball is quite famously intercepted in the end zone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really recommend that people go, you can find it on YouTube. Go listen to Chris Collingsworth call this. So, you know, the ball's intercepted. Obviously, the Seahawks lose because of this. And Chris Collingsworth is just going, I cannot believe this call. What was he thinking? That call was ridiculous. And then when you looked at the headlines the next day, there were a variety of headlines, most of which were declaring it to be the worst call in Super Bowl history. Super Bowl. USA Today called it the worst call in football history.
Okay, so let's step back and examine what's going on here. He had to make a decision. He made a decision in a world or a time period of uncertainty. He had only so much time to bring in all the facts that he could, knowing that skill was going to play a part, some luck was going to play a part, and he had to make a decision. He made a decision that had a bad outcome, but was his decision wrong? What do you think?
Yeah, so I think you actually made the good point of, you pointed out that there was, you know, he only has the information that he has and the time, which is short, that he has to make that decision. And then also, there's a lot of luck in the way that it turns out, right? We know that the ball could be caught, the ball could be just, you know, incomplete, it could be intercepted, you know, there could be a fumble, you know, there's all sorts of different ways that the future can kind of occur there. And there's only one that can occur. And in large part, you know, once Pete Carroll calls that pass play, how that actually ends up turning out is pretty much due to the luck, mm-hmm. which of those things actually occurs. So the question you should really be asking yourself is like, how often does the ball get intercepted there?
Yeah.
You know, is it 40%? I mean, if it's 40%, it's probably a really bad call. But it turns out that when you actually do the math, it's somewhere between above 0% and below 2%.
Really?
So it's that range. Yeah. So if you look over 15 years, of data from the NFL in that, you know, short yardage, I think it was a slant play, but that short yardage play, like, you know, in the red zone, the interception rate over 15 years was, you know, around 2%.
Yeah.
You know, so, and, you know, can you aggregate across 15 years? I don't know, like, you know, the coverage has changed, but let's just say it's 2%. Mm-hmm. So 98% of the time, that really horrible result doesn't occur. And what you're getting exchange for making a pass play there is that if the ball is incomplete, if you don't actually catch it for a touchdown with a win there, the clock actually stops naturally on its own.
Which is good.
Instead of having to burn your timeout, and then you can go hand it off to Marshawn Lynch anyway.
Got it.
So you still get to run that. So It cost him this like really low interception rate. And it was a really, really, really unlikely event.
Yeah.
And yet people acted like it was inevitable.
Well, you know, there's this idea that if your probabilities are 80 favorable and 20 unfavorable, that, you know, you're probably going to win, but someone's got to be in that 20% category. And that's unknowable. And that's really part of the risk. Now, you play poker. Every hand, you're trying to determine what you know and what you don't know and what you can discern from the other poker players across the table. How do you do that so quickly and know that you're making the right decision and also know that you've made the wrong decision?
Yeah, so in the moment, I think that one thing that's really important is to sort of get away from this idea of no, right? It's to really embrace the uncertainty that given the information that I have, this is my estimate of the probability of one or the other things occurring. And what are the things that you're trying to get at there? Well, your opponent's cards are face down to you. So you're trying to figure out sort of what the range of possible hands that they could have is. And the better player you are, the better you are at kind of narrowing down what the possibilities are for your opponent's cards. And then once you figure out what your opponent's cards are, you have to figure out how your opponent's going to react to those cards.
Yeah.
That's really important because one person could have a pair and think it's, you know, the bee's knees, and another person could have a pair and think it's a really horrible hand. So how somebody perceives the hand is going to be different and how they might react to the hand.
Yeah.
So you're trying to sort of plug those variables in, get a guess at that, and then take a look at how often, given these things that I'm sort of guessing at, what's the probability I think that I'm going to win this hand or lose this hand, and then figure out if you're getting the right return on investment. So you kind of get out of this idea of no.
Yeah. Knowing.
Yeah, knowing. And what you say is, no, I'm estimating. I'm estimating what my probabilities are, and I want to get better and better at that so I can figure out if, given the amount of uncertainty that I have, if I'm going to get enough back. And you can think about that in terms of the Pete Carroll play. You know, there's all sorts of stuff that he knew and all sorts of stuff that he didn't know. Just like at the poker table, he had a time limit on making a decision. He made the best decision that he could, given what, you know, the things that he was guessing at about, you know, what the Patriots coverage was going to be, how much they might be expecting a pass play versus a run play, how good their defense was, all this stuff that he's estimating.
Yeah.
And then he says, well, I think it's really low probability that the ball is going to get intercepted. But the fact is, just as you said, I can make a decision that's going to work out 80% of the time. And if the 20% happens, it doesn't mean the decision is wrong. It means the 20% happens.
Let's get to human nature for a second. So our nature, our biases lead us to think that if we have a successful outcome, we've made a good decision. But if we have an unsuccessful outcome, it's bad luck.
Right.
And it's, you know, you didn't get the promotion, not because it was you, because, you know, you did your best. It's because, well, you know, they were a favorite or, you know, whatever the reason was. People tend not to take the blame for their own mistakes, and therefore they don't really move forward in learning how to be more successful.
Yeah, so I think this stands in contrast really nicely with what happened with Pete Carroll. So when you're sort of judging the quality of a decision from afar, right, like I don't have anything to do with Pete Carroll, you do this thing called resulting, which is like, if it's a bad outcome, I assume it's a bad decision. If it's a good outcome, I assume it's a good decision. And you kind of try to make that one-to-one mapping and you ignore how much luck might be in the equation. But what's interesting is that stands in pretty stark contrast to what we do for ourselves, which is we engage in this thing called self-serving bias, which is when it's a really good outcome, you know, we want it to be because we're awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's a bad outcome, we want it to not be our fault. We want it to be like, I can't believe that happened to me, or that was really unfair, those kinds of things. And both really stop you from learning.
I'm talking with Annie Duke. Her book is Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Know All the Facts. Annie, we were talking about why we always have to kind of create a story for ourselves where we are awesome. It's part of human nature, as you say. And actually, when you look at the way we're wired, that's actually a good thing, even though it can lead to a bad result. I know that sounds confusing. Take us through that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, obviously, nobody wants to be depressed, right? Like, I mean, we all want to think well of ourselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is important for us to think that we're sort of good at what we do. The problem is that it depends on whether you're valuing, like, how are you judging whether you're awesome or not? Are you judging whether you're awesome in the short run? Or are you judging kind of your awesomeness in terms of like achieving your long-term goals. So if you're judging your awesomeness in the short run, that you just don't want to feel sort of the pain of taking on the responsibility for something bad that happened, or the pain of a missed opportunity to take on the responsibility for something good that happened. Mm-hmm. What happens is you're making these decisions to feel good in the moment. And it's really bad for learning, because we know that all good things aren't the result of great decision-making.
Yeah.
It's some combination of decisions and luck, and all bad things aren't the result of bad luck. It's some combination of decisions and luck. In the simplest sense, think about if you apply that strategy to drunk driving. Like, you drive drunk, you get home safely. Hey, that's a good outcome.
Yeah.
I must be a great drunk driver. You know, I mean, so we don't want to come to the conclusion that we're a great drunk driver and other things we're doing, whether it's like business or sales or like the way we're treating other people or our investment decisions, you know, just because we have these good outcomes to be like, I'm a great drunk driver. We want to try to figure that out. So it's good to change what your definition of being awesome is. So I like to think of awesome as doing the really hard work of, you know, when I say, ooh, I had a really good result, but I think some of it was due to luck. That actually makes me feel good. It's taken a lot of training for me to get there.
Yeah.
Or when I have a really bad result, saying, you know what? I think I might have made a mistake here. That makes me feel good as well. And the reason why is that when I do that, what I'm trying to focus on is this is going to improve my decisions going forward. So the next time I go to get in a car when maybe I've had too much to drink, I don't do it.
Right.
Because I've been willing to take responsibility.
Andy, let me move on here and talk about the necessity of feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whenever you're at the poker table and someone bets a certain amount in a certain way, that's feedback. You mentioned in the book this idea of conditioning, and they were using rats to test conditioning, and they would have a rat pull levers. And for every 10 times the rat pressed the lever, the rat would get some food. But then in the experiment, they introduced uncertainty where on average, every 10 times the rat would get some food, but it wasn't exactly every 10 times because he may press the lever 20 times and not get anything, or press it one time and get something. So now you've created an amount of uncertainty, even though the average amount of lever pulls is the same. In investing, it's very similar. You know, I think saying the word average in investing is a very dangerous word. And I often tell people, you know, how can you drown in 6 inches of water when it's average 6 inches? And the answer is, well, it's 50 feet in the middle of the lake. It's centimeters at the beach part of the lake. So the average is 6 inches, but you can drown. So average is dangerous. Take us into the world of average and uncertainty and tell us what you make of that.
So first of all, I really appreciate what you just did, because I don't think I've talked to anybody who's talked about that bit about the, you know, classical conditioning and rats pressing levers that I have in the book. So I really appreciate it. That's the first, you are the first person who's mentioned that. So thank you.
Luck, by the way, that was skill.
Yes, no, that was totally skill. Well, it was luck that you were the first person that mentioned it,
okay.
But it was skill that you noticed the importance of it.
Okay.
So the idea is that we can kind of think about what makes it easy to learn from something and what makes it hard to learn from something. So there's two things that make things easy to learn from. The first is that the feedback comes in time for you to do something about it. So, you know, like obviously if you started smoking in 1920, even though, you know, you're destined for emphysema at some point, by the time that you get that feedback, it's too late to do anything about it. So we want to get something back that tells us about the quality of our decision quickly. That's thing number one. But also thing number two, which is what you pointed out, is that there's a really strong correlation between the feedback you get and the decisions that you're making. And this is the difference between a rat pressing a lever every 10 times, which is very consistent feedback, and introducing this uncertainty of on average, which makes it harder to know if I press the lever, am I going to get food or not? Because it's an on average thing. I don't know if it's going to be the next press or the next 20 presses. And that actually makes it really hard to learn from our outcomes.
Aren't the slot machines based upon the fact that there may be a win on average every X amount of times, but the period is totally uncertain?
Yes. And what's interesting about that is that once you have people sort of trained on those slot machines, that they're getting these, you know, variable rewards,
yeah,
you could actually turn the slot machine off in the sense of, make it so it doesn't pay out at all. Mm-hmm. And people would sit at those machines for a very long time. And you know what they would say, right? I'm due. This machine is due.
It's time, right?
Right. And so they're not learning from the feedback that they're getting, that the machine isn't paying out, to actually get up and walk away. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is true in our lives as well, is that we pick out, like, we're trying to find the signal and the noise, and we're very often taking the wrong lessons. So when we go back to this thing of self-serving bias, think about what that's doing for you, right? It's like, if I have a good result, I'm going to repeat that decision over and over again. Well, why can you do that? Well, because the outcome could be because of your decisions. It could be because of luck, and we're not 100% sure.
We're never sure.
So you choose to repeat the decision over and over again. It's like continuing to press the lever. And now in the future, when you don't have the same good result that you had the first try, you pawn it off to luck.
Yeah.
So how do you learn then? It's like, you have a good result. You're like, I'm awesome. I'm going to keep doing that decision. And now you do that decision again. You have a bad result. And you say, well, this time it's because of luck.
I think that happens a lot. I think that happens a lot in the investment world. You know, I've been in it for over 30 years. And you see managers come and go. You see them with a particular strategy that seems to work extremely well. And you think it's skill, but then the metrics of the world change. And now that strategy stops working, and you really wonder how much of that was skill, how much was luck. As a matter of fact, one of the biggest hedge funds just almost collapsed because they made a few terrible bets using the same methodology he was using that made him so successful in the first place. So, you know, there's this problem. The problem is not the market. The problem is not that you're not making enough money at work. The problem is you, that you haven't really figured out how to overcome your biases.
Yeah. And so I think that this is one of the lessons that is really important to take from this, is that, you know, we're not that different from rats in terms of the way that our brains are built when it comes to dealing with this kind of uncertainty mm-hmm. in the relationship between the feedback that we get and the actual quality of decisions. We just like to interpret the world to affirm our own beliefs, to affirm our own positive self-narrative. And we're kind of sort of stuck in that.
What do we do? What do we do to fix this?
So number one, let me just say, like, being smart isn't particularly helpful. And if people are interested in that, they can go read the section of my book that's about that. I think that it's titled Being Smart Makes It Worse. Mm-hmm. So
what do you do if you're smart?
Well,
you have to become humble. That's what it
right.
is. You have to say the three words, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. And then understand the value of other people helping you in the process. So I'm sure you've had this experience. Like, you see somebody doing something, you know, or stating something or applying this, you know, same old strategy that you can see very clearly isn't working anymore. And it's so clear when somebody else is engaging in behavior that's like biased or not rational
right.
or whatever. You can see it crystal clear. But when it comes to your own behavior, it's like when I talk about somebody else, like, oh, they won once and then they lost five times in a row and they're just blaming it on what luck. And you can say, like, oh, that's really dumb.
Mm-hmm.
But you do it for yourself. You're like, no, it really is luck this time because it's me.
Right.
So,
okay.
Take that.
So, like, number one,
get other people involved.
Okay. Get other people involved. Try not to be too smart. Right. I guess that's it.
Right.
I mean, even Buffett says that, you know, he'd rather hire someone who didn't have, you know, a high IQ. It doesn't take a high IQ to be successful in the world of investing. It takes you to understand your behavior and your biases and to learn from them.
Yeah. So, you know, start saying I'm not sure more and recognize that you need to be humble in the face of what you're doing, because what you're doing is probably pretty complicated. Because even, like, you know, driving a car is really complicated, and yeah, we're all pretty overconfident about that. So number one, just recognize that what you're doing is probably pretty hard. And while you might feel that you can make, you know, you're better than on average at making those decisions than other people, you're not better than the game that you're playing. So that's number one.
Mm.
Number two is recognize the power of getting other people to help you. That it's not shameful to say, I had a bunch of other people help work this decision with me. It's not like you deserve less credit, because you should get credit in the first place for recognizing that you're better off bringing other viewpoints into the room, that you're better off having people challenge you about why you might be wrong. You're better off. Here's one of the key things. You're better off having someone make you really rationally justify your decision, where you're not allowed to just say, I know it, I feel it, you know, this is my experience, I'm smart, so I just know this is right. That you have to actually be able to defend your position. Because if you can't defend your position to somebody who's really honestly and seriously challenging you on it, mm-hmm. then you don't know anything about your decision. Mm-hmm. And that's really sort of taken as far, you know, if you can take John Stuart Mill to get to that. And I think that that's, you know, also a form of humility and also a form of recognizing that you don't lose credit because you got help.
Okay. We have to stop there. The book, Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Know All the Facts. My guest, Annie Duke, studied cognitive science in school and is one of the top poker players in the United States.
Well, I used to be. I retired in 2012.
Well, we never talked about The Celebrity Apprentice, and I'm so happy about that. See how smart I am?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, Annie, thank you so much for joining us. And listen, if you have a question about what we just discussed, go to stevepomerantz.com and ask us anything you like. That's stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly newsletter. It comes into your email. You can see all of our segments like this one. You can read it. You can listen to it, whatever you like, stevepomerantz.com. Annie, once again, thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.